Fact and or plus fiction. In 1998, the editors of the interesting lit crit magazine Paradoxa asked me to contribute to an issue on the future of narrative, and this was the result. I have edited and fiddled with it here and there. In earlier times, when we divided narrative into the secular and the sacred, factuality and invention were both considered to be properties of the former and truth the quality of the latter. With the decline of a consensus opinion concerning truth, the difference between fact and fiction began to take on more importance, and we took to dividing narrative into fiction and nonfiction. This division, maintained by publishers, librarians, booksellers, teachers, and most writers, I find to be fundamental to my own concept of narrative and its uses. The file in my computer that I'm using now is labeled Nonfiction in Progress, as distinct from the Fiction in Progress file. But perhaps as part of the postmodern boundary breakdown, some files are coalescing. A lot of fiction seems to be getting into certain types of nonfiction. I like genre transgression, but this may involve more than genre. To start thinking about it, I called, as usual, on the OED. Fiction. 1 and 2, obsolete usages. 3a, the action of feigning or inventing imaginary incidents, existences, states of things, etc., whether for the purpose of deception or otherwise. Bacon, 1605, so great an affinity hath fiction and belief. B. That which, or something that, is imaginatively invented, feigned existence, event, or state of things, invention as opposed to fact. First citation, 1398. 4. The species of literature which is concerned with the narration of imaginary events and the portraiture of imaginary characters, fictitious composition. Now, usually, prose novels and stories collectively, the composition of works of this class. First citation, 1599. Definitions 5 and after concern non-literary and derogatory uses of the word, deliberate falsehood, moonshine, yarn spinning, and so on. As for the word nonfiction, it isn't in the OED. Probably if I went to a contemporary American dictionary, I'd find it. But not having one, and having found the thesaurus in my Macintosh a nice source of current usage, I asked it for its synonyms and antonyms to fiction. It gave me story as the principal synonym, then unreality, and then drama, fantasy, myth, novel, romance, legend, tale. All these synonyms, except unreality, have to do with the literary use of the word. The principal antonym is actuality, then authenticity, biography, certainty, circumstance, event, face, fact, genuineness, happening, history, incident, occurrence, reality. Only two of the antonyms refer to literature, history and biography. The antonyms didn't include nonfiction, which I thought a quite common word by now. I tried the thesaurus with nonfiction. All it could give me was what it calls a close word, fiction. Is my Macintosh telling me the words fiction and nonfiction are so close in meaning they can be used interchangeably? Possibly this is what is happening. A good deal has been said and written here and there about this blurring of definition or melding of modes, though I don't know of a methodical or scholarly study. Most of what I've read on the subject has been by nonfiction writers defending their use of techniques and freedoms that have been seen as pertaining properly or only to fiction. Their arguments include the following. Since total accuracy is impossible, invention in a purportedly factual report is inevitable. Since nobody perceives the same event the same way, factuality is always in question. Artistic license may reach a higher form of authenticity than mere accuracy, and, therefore, anyhow, writers have the right to write a story the way they want to. The journalist Janet Malcolm, sued by her interviewee Jeffrey Masson for deliberate and defamatory misquotation, defended her form of journalism in a New Yorker article with such arguments. Perhaps she was inspired by Truman Capote, who called his In Cold Blood, also published in the New Yorker, a nonfiction novel, apparently to elevate it above mere reportage and incidentally defend himself from accusations of playing a bit fast and loose with facts. Some nonfiction writers vigorously defend their use of invented elements in their work. Others take it for granted and are surprised by objections. In conversation, I have heard that nature writing often contains a good deal of invention, and that some well-known nature writers admit without shame to faking observations and relating experiences that didn't occur. But the principal entryway of fiction into nonfiction seems to be via autobiographical writing, the memoir or personal essay. Two relevant quotes from reviewers, for which I thank Sarah Jameson, who sent them to me. W.S. DiPiero, in the New York Times Book Review of March 8, 1998, "Remembering is an act of the imagination. Any account we make of our experience is an exercise in reinventing the self, even when we think we're accurately reporting past events, persons, objects, places, and their sequence, we're theatricalizing the self and its world." I find the term reinventing the self interesting. Who did the original invention? Is the implication that of an eternal self-invention, the relationship of which to experience or reality is unimportant? The word theatricalizing is also interesting. Theatrical isn't a neutral word, but loaded with connotations of exaggeration and emotional falsehood. In the same issue, Paul Levy wrote, "All autobiographers have a problem conjuring with the truth. My own strategy is to regard writing about oneself as inadvertent fiction." Conjuring has the same ring to it as theatricalizing, autobiography as sleight of hand, doves out of thin air. The phrase inadvertent fiction not only disclaims the writer's responsibility, but offers irresponsibility as a strategy. This approach certainly could slide an autobiographer over the difficulties faced by writers unwilling to regard their art as inadvertent. A related argument concerns objectivity, famed cornerstone of the scientific method, which many scientists now consider as a realistic criterion of even the most painstakingly factual report of an experiment or observation, illusory. Feminists add that, as an ideal, it is in many ways undesirable. Anthropologists have generally come to admit that accounts of ethnographical observations from which the observer is omitted contain a profound element of falsification. Ethnography these days is full of postmodern uncertainties, ellipses, and self-reflexivities, sometimes to the point of appearing to be less about the native's behavior than the ethnographer's soul. Claude Lévi-Strauss's Triste Tropique, the founding classic of this subtle and risky genre, exhibits its value when performed by a truly searching, skillful subjectivity. In writing this essay, I consciously include my subjective reactions and partialities as part of the process and lay no claim to either objectivity or authority. This is, to put it mildly, not how I was taught to write at Harvard in the 40s. To me, it seems perfectly appropriate to what I am doing, which is mostly speculation and opinion, as were most of the authoritatively phrased and apparently egoless papers produced at Harvard in the 40s. If, however, I were an eyewitness journalist charged with describing an event, if I were writing a biography or an autobiography, could I not claim a genuine authority based not only on knowledge, research, perceptivity and inclusiveness, but also on a strenuous attempt to be objective? When scientists come out and state that they cannot achieve objectivity, and historians follow suit, a certain demoralization may follow. Objectivity was an ideal to journalists, too. If the scientists abandon it, why should a poor stiff working part-time for the local foreign corporation-owned rag even try for it? Yet most journalists still profess the ideal of objective reporting, even when it comes to highly subjective matters. No proper journalist has ever admitted that anybody who does or suffers anything that brings them into public attention, intentionally or not, has any right to privacy. But in practice, journalists respect privacy when they describe objective actions and speech, leaving subjective motives, thoughts, and feelings to be deduced from the description. And outside the tabloids, most journalists do that. Serious journalism defines itself by the avoidance of speculation presented as fact. Though they may have abandoned the claim to objectivity, serious history and biography define themselves in the same way. As soon as the writer tells us what Napoleon murmured to Josephine in bed and how Josephine's heart went pit-pat, we know we're nearer Oz than Paris. Many readers, of course, want Oz, not Paris. They're reading for the story, and don't care if the story is inaccurate or if the characters make a travesty of the historical figures they're based on. Why, then, are they reading history rather than a novel? Is it because they distrust the novel as being made up, while the narrative that calls itself history or biography, however dishonest, is real? Such a bias, reflecting the Puritan judgmentalism so common in American minds, turns up in many and unlikely places. I hear a ring of such absolutism in both the New York Times book review quotations previously mentioned, with their emphasis on theatricality and conjuring. You can't tell the whole truth, nothing less will do, so you fake it. But it's equally possible that many or most American readers are genuinely indifferent to the distinction of fiction from nonfiction. These categories mean little or nothing in pre-literate cultures, and even now, when the written word is the word that counts, ever more so as we increasingly communicate via electronic media, perhaps they are not generally seen as carrying any great intellectual or ethical significance. This perception may be in part connected to the increasing electronicization of writing. Insofar as writing becomes electronic, surely its categories and genres will change. So far, the new technology has influenced fiction only by opening to the novelist the garden of forking paths accessible through hypertext. Genuinely interactive fiction, where the reader would control the text equally with the writer, remains hype or a promise, or to some, a threat. As for nonfiction, it seems that scant care for accuracy and fact-checking, along with wide tolerance of hearsay and opinion, characterize a lot of what passes for information on the Internet. The transitory nature of net communication encourages a freedom like that of private conversation. Rumor-mongering, gossip, pontification, unverified quotation, and backchat all flow freely through cyberspace, shortcutting the skills and/or self-restraints of both fiction and factual writing. The pseudo-oral, pseudonymous, transitory character of electronic writing encourages an easy abdication of the responsibility that accrues to print. But that responsibility may be truly out of place in the net. A new form of writing has to develop its own aesthetic and ethic. That's to come. In this essay, I'm talking about print, the essence of which is that it gives writing reproducible permanence. All permanence in human terms involves responsibility. A group I belong to that gives annual awards to writers got a letter recently asking us to divide our nonfiction prize into two, one for historical nonfiction and one for creative nonfiction. The first term was new to me. The second was familiar. Writing workshops and programs all over the country now offer courses in creative nonfiction. The arts of scientific, historical, and biographical narrative are rarely, if ever, taught in such programs or anywhere else. Autobiography, however, has been increasingly popular in the writing programs. It may be taught as journal writing or as therapy through self-expression. When it has more literary goals, it is called creative nonfiction, personal essay, and memoir. The writer of a memoir, like the responsible biographer, ethnographer, or journalist, used to describe what other people did and said, leaving what they may have felt and thought as implications to be drawn by the reader, or as authorial speculation identified as such. The autobiographer limited her account to her own memory of how her Uncle Fred looked as he ate the grommet, what she heard him say when he'd swallowed it, and what she thought about it. The only sensations and emotions she described were her own. According to those who defend the use of fictional devices and elements in nonfiction, the memoirist is justified in telling us how, as he swallowed it, Fred vividly recalled the slightly oily taste of the first grommet he ever ate 50 years ago in Indiana, and how bittersweet the memory was to him. Many writers and readers of creative nonfiction hold that such ascription of inward thought or feeling, if it's based on a knowledge of Fred's character, is legitimate. It does no harm to Fred, who died in 1980 of a surfeit of grommets, and no harm to the reader, who, after all, will almost certainly know Fred only in and through the story, just as if he were a character in a novel. But who is to certify the writer's knowledge of her uncle's character as accurate, unbiased, reliable? Possibly her aunt, but we're not likely to have the chance to consult her aunt. The memoirist's responsibility seems to me to be exactly that of the ethnographer, not to pretend to objectivity, but also not to pretend to be able to speak for anybody but oneself. To assign oneself the power to tell us what another person thought or felt is, to my mind, co-optation of a voice, an act of extreme disrespect. The reader who accepts the tactic colludes in the disrespect. Characters come alive in a story, fictive or factual. They seem real, not, of course, through the mere report of their actions and words, but by selection, suppression, rearrangement, and interpretation of that material. I take it this is what Mr. DiPiero, quoted previously, meant by remembering is an act of the imagination. It may be what Genli I, in my novel The Left Hand of Darkness, meant by saying that he was taught on his home world that truth is a matter of the imagination, but Genli, of course, wasn't real. The most cogent argument in support of the use of invention in nonfiction is, then, as fiction involves the arrangement, manipulation, and interpretation of inventions, so creative nonfiction involves the arrangement, manipulation, and interpretation of actual events. A short story is an invention. A memoir is a reinvention. And the difference between them is negligible. I accept the terms, but the conclusion makes me uneasy. It's not just that many readers evidently don't know whether a story they just read is factual, invented, or a mixture, and don't care. They do care, in the sense that I discussed before. American readers tend to value factuality over invention, reality over imagination. They're uncomfortable with the fictivity of fiction. Perhaps this is why they beg novelists to tell them, where do you get your ideas from? The only honest answer is, of course, I make them up, but that's not the answer they want. They want specific sources. In my experience, most readers vastly exaggerate the dependence of fiction on research and immediate experience. They assume that characters in a story are taken from somebody the author knows, based on a specific person used as copy, and believe that a story or novel is necessarily preceded by research. This latter illusion may rise from the necessity most writers are under of writing applications for grants. You can't tell the guys with the money that you don't actually need to spend 6 months in the Library of Congress doing research for your novel. You've been drawing maps of Glongo ever since you were 10. You worked out the curious mores and social structure of the Glongovians when you were 20. The plot and characters of Thunder Lords of Glongo are ready and waiting in your mind, and all you need is the 6 months to write the story and some peanut butter to live on. But peanut butter and made-up stories aren't what grants are given for. Grants are for serious things, like research. The notion that fictional characters are all portraits of actual people probably arises from natural vanity and paranoia, and is encouraged by the power fantasies of some fiction writers. You're nothing to me but copy. Tracing back elements of great novel characters, Jane Eyre, Natasha, Mrs. Dalloway, To this or that element of real people the writer knew is an entertaining and sometimes revealing critico-biographical game. But involved in all such searches for the non-fiction in the fiction is, I suspect, a distrust of the fictive, a resistance to admitting that novelists make it up, that fiction is not reproduction, but invention. If invention is so much distrusted, why is it admitted where it doesn't belong? Maybe this insistence that fiction is really not made up, but derived immediately from fact, is what has established the confusion of modes that, as if reciprocally, permits the entry of fictional data into purported non-fiction. Nothing comes from nothing. The novelist's ideas do come from somewhere. The poet Gary Snyder's finely unpoetic image of composting is useful here. Stuff goes into the writer, a whole lot of stuff, not notes in a notebook, but everything seen and heard and felt all day, every day. A lot of garbage, leftovers, dead leaves, eyes of potatoes, artichoke stems, forests, streets, rooms in slums, mountain ranges, voices, screams, dreams, whispers, smells, blows, eyes, gates, gestures, the touch of a hand, a whistle in the night, the slant of light on the wall of a child's room, a fin in a waste of waters. All this stuff goes down into the novelist's personal compost bin, where it combines, recombines, changes, gets dark, mulchy, fertile, turns into ground. A seed falls into it. The ground nourishes the seed with the richness that went into it, and something grows. But what grows isn't an artichoke stem and a potato eye and a gesture. It's a new thing, a new whole. It's made up. That's how I understand the process of using fact, experience, memory in fictional narrative. It seems to me the process of using fact, experience, memory in nonfiction is entirely different. In a memoir, the artichoke stem remains itself. The remembered light that slants across the wall can be placed and dated, a room in a house in Berkeley in 1936. These memories are immediate to the writer's mind. They weren't composted, but saved. Memory is an active and imperfect process. Memories are shaped and selected, often profoundly, in that process. Like souls in heaven, they are saved, but changed. When the writer comes to make them into a coherent story, in the interests of clarity, comprehensibility, impetus, and other aims of narrative art, they'll be selected from, emphasized, omitted, interpreted, and thoroughly worked over. Nothing in these processes makes them fictional. They're still, to the best of the author's ability, genuine memories. But if the remembered facts are deliberately changed or rearranged, they become false. If the artichoke stem is made a zinnia because the writer finds the zinnia more aesthetically effective, if the light falls aslant on the wall in 1944 because that date fits more conveniently into the narrative, they're no longer facts or memories of facts. They are fictional elements in a piece that calls itself nonfiction. And when in reading a memoir I suspect or identify such elements, they cause me intense discomfort. I'll let Tolstoy tell me what Napoleon thought and felt, because although his novel is full of well-researched historical facts, that's not why I'm reading it. I'm reading it for the values proper to the novel as a work of invention. If certain aspects of the author's Uncle Fred get into a short story where he's called Cousin Jim and eats washers, I'll accept their rubbery taste without a qualm because it's a story, and I take Cousin Jim to be a fictional character. It's when I'm not quite sure what I'm reading that qualms arise. It can happen even when there is a surfeit of fact in what calls itself fiction. Reading for a jury for a fiction award, I fretted to a fellow juror about one of the books. Was it really a novel? It read like a pure relation of the author's boyhood, an honest, accurate, touching memoir, barely disguised with a few name changes. How could we tell? The author calls it a novel, said my friend, and so I read it as fiction and judge it as such. Dealer's call. If the writer calls it nonfiction, read it as fact. If the writer calls it a novel, read it as fiction. I tried. I couldn't do it. Fiction involves invention. Fiction is invention. I can't read a book in which nothing is invented as a novel. I couldn't give a fiction award to a book that contains only facts, any more than I could give a prize for journalism to The Lord of the Rings. A real novel, an entirely fictive and imaginative tale, can contain vast amounts of fact without being any less fictional for it. Historical fiction and science fiction, which, by the way, often really does require research, may be full of solid, useful information concerning an era or a body of knowledge. The ploy of the whole realistic genre is to put invented characters into a framework of reproduced actuality. Imaginary toads in a real garden, to twist Marianne Moore. All fiction serves later generations as descriptive evidence of its time, place, society. For keen observation and recording of ordinary people's lives, very little ethnography has ever equaled the novel. But it doesn't work the other way. The historian, biographer, anthropologist, autobiographer, nature writer have to use real gardens and real toads. Therein lies their proper creativity, not in inventing, but in making recalcitrant reality into a story without faking it. Anything written contains an implicit contract which can be honored or broken in the writing or in the reading or in the presentation by the publisher. The first and most tenuous and intangible contract is between the writer and his or her conscience, and goes something like this. In this piece, I will try to tell my story truly, using the means I find appropriate to the form, whether fiction or nonfiction. Then there's a more verifiable agreement between the writer and the reader, the terms of which vary immensely, depending, in the first place, on the sophistication of both. An experienced reader may follow a sophisticated writer through a whole gallery of tricks and illusions with perfect confidence that there will be no aesthetic betrayal. For more naive readers, however, the terms of the contract depend largely on how the writer and publisher present the work, as factual, imaginative, or a mixture of the two. Reader as well as writer can twist the terms of this contract, reading a novel as if it were an account of actual events, or a piece of reportage as if it were pure invention. Despite the great affinity of fiction and belief, only the very innocent believe what novelists tell them. But an attitude of distrust towards nonfiction may well be the result of experience. One has been disappointed so often. For though a whole swarm of facts in a novel doesn't in the least invalidate the invention as a whole, every fictive or even inaccurate element in a narrative that presents itself as factual puts the whole thing at risk. To pass a single invention off as a fact is to damage the credibility of the rest of the narrative. To keep doing so is to disauthenticate it entirely. Lincoln's aphorism about fooling people applies, as usual. The writer who reports inaccurately or presents invention as fact is, consciously or not, exploiting the reader's ignorance. Only the informed reader is aware that the contract has been violated. If amused enough, this reader may privately rewrite the contract, reading the so-called nonfiction as mere entertainment, hokum, fiction in the OED's fifth definition. Perhaps the terms of the contract are currently being rewritten by the writers. Perhaps the whole idea of a contract is hopelessly pre-postmodern, and readers are coming to accept false data in nonfiction as calmly as they accept factual information in fiction. Certainly, we've become so numbed by the quantity of unverifiable information poured out upon us that we admit factoids as more or less equivalent to facts. And with the same numbness, we are generally acceptant of hype of all kinds, advertising, stories about celebrity figures, political leaks, patriotic and moralistic declarations, and so on. Reading it without much caring if the material is credible or that we're being treated as objects of manipulation. If this non-distinction of the fictive and the factual is a general trend, Maybe we should celebrate it as a victory of creativity over unimaginative, indiscriminate factualism. I worry about it, however, because it seems to me that by not distinguishing invention from lying, it puts imagination itself at risk. Whatever creative means, I don't think the term can fairly be applied to falsification of data and memories, whether intentional or inevitable. Excellence in nonfiction lies in the writer's skills in observing, organizing, narrating, and interpreting facts. Skills entirely dependent on imagination, used not to invent, but to connect and illuminate observation. Writers of nonfictional narrative who create facts introduce inventions for the sake of aesthetic convenience, wishful thinking, spiritual solace, psychic healing, vengeance, profit, or anything else, aren't using the imagination, but betraying it.